welcome to the program. Is the world really as clear as what we see in front of our nose? If you're sitting watching a basketball game and a gorilla walks into the room, would you notice? What if what we see, what we believe, is but a distorted reflection of reality? That our angle of vision, in fact, determines our reality? We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Daniel Simons. He is a psychology professor at the University of Illinois. He received his PhD from Cornell, and he's the co-author of The Invisible Gorilla and Other Ways Our Intuitions Deceive Us. Daniel Simons, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. This notion of inattentional blindness, which is really at the core of this, talk about what that means, first of all.
Sure. So inattentional blindness is basically a consequence of something that we do quite well, which is focusing our attention. So when we look at the world, we take in far less than we think we do, and we focus attention intently on whatever it is we're trying to do. And the result of that is we have to filter out things that we don't want to distract us. Inattentional blindness is a consequence of that. It's an occasional filtering out of something that's unexpected that we might actually want to see.
And in the world today where there is so much more coming at us, so much that we have to see and read and understand and comprehend, just so much more information around us, is the inattentional blindness that results increasing in the world today?
I wouldn't say that inattentional blindness per se is increasing. It's not that the fundamental capacities of our attention system have changed with changing technology and changing speed of everything. What has changed are the consequences. So if you imagine kind of in evolutionarily primitive times, there just wasn't as much information. If we didn't notice something for a moment or two, it wasn't that big a deal. Now, if you fail to notice something when you're driving 60 miles an hour, it can be the difference between life and death.
Right. I mean, the world we've evolved into is very different than our ability to sort of respond to it based on evolutionary biology.
That's right. And what we point out in our book, The Invisible Gorilla, is the many ways in which our intuitions about how our minds work are based on much simpler sort of processing. They're based on times when we didn't have so much coming at us all the time so quickly.
Talk about this experiment, which you did back in, I guess, 1999, with the gorilla in the basketball game.
Sure. So this was a study that Chris Chabria and I did. Back when I was teaching at Harvard, and Chris was my teaching assistant for an undergraduate lab class, and as part of the class, we decided to replicate and repeat some much earlier studies done by Ulrich Neisser, in which he showed videos of people passing basketballs. So we'd have three people wearing white shirts passing a ball and three people wearing black shirts passing a ball. And he'd give people the task of just counting how many times, say, the players wearing white passed the ball. And it's a focused attention task. It requires you to focus selectively on just the players in white and not the players in black and keep track of the total number of times they pass the ball. Now, what he was interested in was an aspect of attention that has to do with whether you're focusing on objects or spaces. But in the middle of the event, he would have something unexpected happen. So in his case, he used a person holding an open umbrella walking through the middle of the game. And what he found was that people didn't notice that. But in his videos, because of what he was after, he made all of the actors and the umbrella woman partially transparent. So it all had this kind of weird, ghostly, hard-to-see appearance. And the consequence of that is it gave people an excuse for why they might have missed this person with the umbrella. They would just say, well, yeah, I missed it, but it was hard to see. So our goal was to basically do that study, but in a way that wouldn't give people any excuses if they missed something. So we had the whole scene, same task, counting how many times players passed the basketball, but it was all shot with a single camera live, and we had a person wearing a gorilla suit walk through the middle of the scene. And in one case, we had the person in the gorilla suit walk into the scene, turn and face the camera, thump her chest, walk off the other side 9 seconds later, and we found that half the time people didn't notice.
And that even if the gorilla was in a red suit, 30% of the time people didn't notice.
Yeah, the red suit was it was a metaphorically red gorilla. We used a simplified computer display in which people were tracking, say, white shapes, circles and squares moving around the display and ignoring black shapes. And when you do that and you have a bright red cross go through the middle of the display, we found that about 30% of people missed it.
To what extent is it different if you do this experiment in real space as opposed to people seeing it on a video?
It's a great question, and it's really hard to do, as it turns out. So this is a phenomenon that I think occurs in the real world all the time. the trick in doing a real-world study like that is you'd have to set it up in front of the observer with all of the actors and all of the events happening, and it'd be very hard to control the displays to make sure people were seeing the same thing.
Uh-huh.
That said, I think the same phenomenon does apply in a lot of real-world contexts, and we have done some variants of this that happen in the real world. So a colleague of mine has shown that people can miss, while walking down a path, can miss somebody in a clown suit unicycling next to the side of the road. That's Ira Hyman. And it's amplified by talking on a cell phone.
Mm-hmm. Of course, one of the examples that relates to this whole idea of expectation, what we expect to see and how that plays into it, is really what pilots see sometimes or don't see on the ground.
Exactly. So there's a really interesting study, kind of a precursor of some of these games with the gorilla, in which Richard Haynes showed people, commercial airline pilots, so these are very experienced pilots, in a high-end flight simulator, at least for the time. And he had them using what's known as a head-up display, so it projected some of their flight information onto their windshield so that they don't have to look away. Right? And the intuition there is that it'd be a good thing if people could keep looking where they're going and not have to look away at all their instruments. But what he found was that after people were flying in the simulator a number of times, he'd have them come in for a landing under slightly cloudy conditions. So they'd drop below the cloud ceiling, they'd approach the runway, they're using their head-up display, and some of the pilots never noticed that there was another jet sitting on the runway where they were about to land. Two of them landed right through it, never seeing it. This is in a simulator, fortunately.
Right.
But when people think about airline disasters, they tend to think of mid-air collisions between planes, and it turns out those are extraordinarily rare. Much more common are what's known as runway incursions, where a plane is supposed to be on a taxiway but ends up on a runway where it shouldn't be, and another plane is using that runway. And those sorts of accidents, by definition, are human error. They're either the pilot error, they're going someplace where they shouldn't be, or air traffic control error, that they were sent someplace where they shouldn't have been.
To what extent is that a result of expectation, not expecting to see that plane on the runway, and processing information in a way that's kind of ahead of where we actually are?
I think that's exactly right. It's really due to what we expect to see. And most of the time, we have to focus attention. We have limited resources. We can't take in everything. So we have to focus on what makes the most sense to be there. So you're not looking for planes on the runway because there typically aren't planes on the runway. Air traffic control typically tells you where to go, and they direct people so that there's not that sort of a potential obstacle there. In the same way that you don't expect to see a gorilla walking through the middle of a basketball game. You're focused on what you're told to pay attention to.
And, of course, all of this goes to the source of what we commonly refer to as intuition, this idea, as you just said, that we can't make a decision about everything. We can't process every single piece of information, so we have to act intuitively some of the time.
We have this intuition, most of us do, that if something important happens in front of us, we'll actually rely on it. We'll actually notice it automatically. So most people, if you tell them about the video with the basketball game and the gorilla going through it, if you describe it to them and say, hey, what percentage of people do you think would notice the gorilla? Or how likely would you be to notice the gorilla? About 90% say, well, yeah, of course I would notice the gorilla. That's, in some sense, what makes it so powerful and so surprising is that it's counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm.
We fully expect that if something important happens, it will grab our attention. And that sort of implicit assumption that we make, that intuition that we have, helps to explain a lot of our behaviors. So, for example, people feel like they can drive and talk on a cell phone at the same time, even though the evidence is overwhelming that we can't. And the intuition that we can do this has led to a lot of laws banning the use of handheld phones. Right? People have started to realize that, you know, this might be bad, but banning handheld phones doesn't really solve the problem, because the problem has nothing to do with holding on to the wheel. It has to do with our heads. We can't focus attention on that much, and things don't automatically grab attention.
Uh-huh.
So the intuition is that, oh, as long as I have both hands on the wheel, I could respond quickly. You know, I could react to something when I see it. And the problem is you just don't see it.
Of course, we've been told more and more lately that we can rely on intuition, which is sort of counterintuitive.
Yeah. I think the power of intuition is something that's gotten a lot of play, largely in the wake of books like Malcolm Gladwell's Blink, which is a wonderful book. I think his position was somewhat more nuanced than it's been taken to be. I think a lot of people have taken that book as a license to go with your gut under all sorts of circumstances, making all sorts of complex decisions, when in reality that's probably not a good idea. And one class of intuitions tends to be consistently wrong, and that's intuitions about how our own minds work.
Explain that.
So intuitions about some things are great. If you have to make a decision about what sort of ice cream you like best, or who you find the most attractive, or whether or not you're in love with somebody, no amount of rational analysis is going to help with those decisions. But if you're trying to decide what sort of stock to invest in, or how well you know a content domain, those sorts of things are going to lend themselves much better to detailed analysis than they are to intuition. Intuitions about our minds are based on our immediate personal experiences. They're reasonable intuitions to have. But in the modern society, with the amount of complexity we have, they often lead us astray. So take, for example, how we infer the causes of different kinds of events. Right? A natural thing for us to do is to reason based on our personal experiences and what we hear from a friend. So we give undue weight to those sorts of personal experiences and to stories we hear. So, for example, if you're buying a car and you're looking at, say, consumer reports and looking at what the statistics are, that's a reasonably good way to make a decision. But if you have an Uncle Joey who had a Toyota that was a lemon and he tells you about it, you're going to be unduly influenced by that one bit of information over the statistics of hundreds of thousands of people. We naturally think in terms of stories, in terms of anecdote, in terms of personal experience. And that would have served us very well in times before we had, you know, Google and search engines or even the written word to compile that sort of information.
Right.
We're built to rely on stories.
How much of this has to do with how we process memory, how we record information in our brain?
I think a lot. So the second chapter of our book, The Invisible Gorilla, is about what we call the illusion of memory. And this is another case in which our intuitions about what we remember are often wrong. We tend to think of memory as a lot like a video camera that we can play back in some detail. So if you think back about how you heard about some personally significant or, say, nationally significant event, you often recall that in great detail. So if you think about how you first heard about the attacks on September 11th, right, you'll probably have vivid memories. You'll remember who you were with, how you heard about it, who told you, what you were doing right before you heard about it, what you were doing immediately after you heard about it, and you'll recall those details with great vividness and precision. And the problem is we take that vividness as a good predictor of how accurate those memories are, and it turns out that that vividness isn't a great predictor of how accurate the memories are. It's just that we rarely have an opportunity to go back and inspect those memories and actually look at archival records or videotapes of what we were doing at the time to verify that they're wrong.
This is relates to the whole idea also of implanted memory, that we might hear a story while we're growing, a story about something that happened to us when we were a kid growing up, and then after a while we believe we remember that incident, even though we probably don't.
Yeah, some wonderful work by Elizabeth Loftus over the years, and some of her colleagues as well, have shown that basically it's possible to implant memories of things that had never happened. One of my favorite examples of this comes from a study in which people were shown photographs of themselves as a child on a hot air balloon ride. And the researchers checked to see whether these people had ever been on a hot air balloon ride, and they hadn't. But they photoshopped this image so that you had, you know, the child with their, you know, with their family on a hot air balloon ride. And they showed it to them over and over again and asked them to recall memories about it. And eventually, people incorporated it as their own memory. It became something that was just as real to them as any other memory.
So the bottom line is that our past is really our remembered past, or as we perceive those memories.
Yeah, and that's what's so frustrating about memory. We feel that what we're recalling is perfectly vivid and accurate. And in reality, it's much more of a reconstruction over time. I like to think of it as not like playing back a recording of at Carnegie Hall, but more like an improvisational performance, that each time you recall it, it gets embellished a little bit, it can get changed a little bit, it gets distorted to make sense. It becomes a story. And the problem is that intuitively we don't realize that that's what we're doing. We think that we're recalling a vivid record, a videotape of what we experienced, but what we're actually doing is constructing it on the fly, and that's why two people witnessing the same event can have completely different memories. They're interpreting it based on what's meaningful to them.
Right. Which makes the whole business of memoir and the accuracy of memoir so interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's anytime you don't have documentary records, what you're basically doing is telling the story. And there's going to be some evidence, you know, that you can use to back it up, mostly circumstantial evidence that you'll be able to back up those, you know, historical memories. But, you know, memories are inherently fallible. We have a tendency to modify them to make them make sense.
Have there been examples where two people have sort of heard the same stories, been implanted in some respects with the same memory, and evolved the story jointly that in fact was not accurate?
That's a really interesting question. I don't know. That's sort of,
I mean, you could imagine that, yeah, in terms of a couple's experience, for example, mm-hmm, that they've told each other the same stories or heard the same stories long enough that they both believe them, even though they may not be in fact accurate.
I'm sure that's true. Stories are self-reinforcing. So if we hear a good story and it makes sense to us, it's something that we incorporate as a meaningful thing. And yeah, it could very easily have a couple, I could imagine, very easily having a couple distort their memory so that they both come to remember something that never happened.
And you look at something like James Fry and wonder, maybe he did believe that.
Well, you know, there are lots of interesting cases like this. There are cases of unintentional plagiarism by authors, very well-known authors, who have written about a story enough times that they come to believe it actually happened to them when it actually was somebody else's story that they just heard at some point.
Talk about the importance of stories, the values of stories, and the role it plays in both implanting the memory and in retrieving the memory.
Well, if you think about the goal of what our visual system is designed to do and what our memory system is designed to do, when we look at the world, what we're trying to do is extract the meaning. And we have limited resources to do that. We can't focus on everything. We have to focus selectively on those things that seem meaningful to us. So as you process the world, you're inherently filtering it already. You're already making it into a story, a narrative about what's going on in your environment. And that's what memory takes cues on as well. So when you've encoded it in the form of something meaningful, your memory for it is going to take that shape too. What that means is that basically, as you're remembering, you're trying to piece things together in a way that makes sense. It's much harder to remember an arbitrary list of facts than a set of facts that go together in some sort of meaningful way.
It sort of reminds you of the old game of telephone that kids would play, where you tell the story, you know, people, five or six people around in a circle, and you pass the story along, and it changes by the end.
Exactly. So, in fact, some of the great early studies of memory distortion by Frederick Bartlett in the 1930s used that method. Instead of doing it from one person to the next, so one person says something to the next person who whispers it to the next person until by the end it has nothing to do with the original statement. What Bartlett did was told people a story that was kind of hard to understand. It was a folk tale that was a Native American folk tale that didn't have kind of traditional Western story structure. So for a Western subject, it didn't really hold together in the way that you'd expect a normal narrative to. And what happened was that they'd have that same person recall the story over and over again over time, and the story became systematically changed. It changed so that it became more coherent from a Western perspective. It gradually lost the elements that didn't quite fit in and acquired some that made more sense in the context. And this was within a single person, basically playing the telephone game with themselves.
Right.
And in essence, that's what we do every time we recall a memory. We're playing that telephone game with ourselves and recalling it as in a meaningful way, but it changes over time.
It certainly doesn't give us a lot of faith in people's powers of observation in, for example, a criminal situation or a lineup or something like that.
In fact, that's one of the big problems with our legal system. Our legal system is founded on the idea of, you know, facing your accuser and eyewitnesses. It's based on witnesses testifying about what they experienced. And the problem is that witnesses misunderstand the nature of their own memories, and juries don't understand the nature of memories and confidence. So if you look at people who've been exonerated from death row, people who were, you know, basically sentenced to death, but then later found to be innocent, typically through DNA testing, in almost all of those cases, they were convicted based on the testimony of confident witnesses. And that means you had a witness who was sure that they saw that person committing the crime or that had good memory for it. They were confident about their memory, and they were wrong.
Uh-huh.
And confident witnesses are incredibly persuasive. Right? Juries tend to find them believable because we mistakenly think that confidence of an individual is linked to their accuracy.
Of course, the other side of that coin, or another side of that coin, is really, you know, great defense lawyers whose talent really is to be able to take all the facts, the information, and weave a different story and make people believe that story.
Yeah, and really it comes down to a battle between two stories, the prosecution's story of what happened and the defense's story of what happened, and the question is the defense's story believable enough that there's doubt? There's a lot of interesting work recently on the use of video reenactments and computer simulations in courts. And one of my colleagues, Neil Rose, has done some nice work looking at the impact of these on how people think about the events. And if you, say, show a reconstruction of a car accident, that's just one interpretation. It's one story about what happened. But because it's so vivid and concrete, it's hard for people to imagine that any other story could explain the same set of facts.
Mm-hmm. What about this idea that each time we repeat a story, every time we tell a story, that it becomes a new part of our memory, it becomes a new source?
Well, in a sense, that's true. The issue is that we don't have really concrete memories that are in a permanent form. Memory is ever-changing. So I don't know that I would necessarily say it's a new memory, but it could be the same memory just gradually being transformed over time.
Uh-huh. To the extent that we get information today in different ways, that it is coming at us in so many different forms, how is that impacting on how we process all of this and what we remember?
Well, I think part of the issue is that we really can't take in everything that's around us. There are really some pretty strong structural limits on how much information we can process. If you think about just the limits of our eyes, you know, we can't see ultraviolet light, so there's just a lot of information in that spectrum that we're not taking in. Well, in addition to those limits on the physical system, what information we can take in with our eyes, there are limits on our cognitive system, what information we can take in with our mind and become aware of. And because of those limits, we really can't take in everything around us. We have to select. And there's just simply too much information to take in everything, even though we often think we can. And it's that intuition that it's all there and we can just grab it if we need it that leads us to believe we have a much, much more complete understanding of what's around us, more situation awareness than we do.
What is the cutting edge of the research now? What are you still and your colleagues still trying to find out?
Well, I think there are a lot of interesting questions. I mean, there's a wide range of research that looks at these sorts of failures of awareness that I'm still working on as well. One of the topics that I find interesting right now is whether there are consistent individual differences in who's likely to notice unexpected events and who's not.
Mm-hmm.
There are individual differences in basic attention abilities, how much information you can hold on to, how much you can take in one glance, how good your memory capacity is. But the question is, do those differences in our ability to attend to the world influence whether or not we notice unexpected things better?
Mm-hmm.
And so far, the evidence is suggesting that not so much, that just because you're better able to take in and hold on to more information doesn't seem to predict, at least not that strongly, whether or not you'll notice something unexpected.
It arguably, is the reverse true, that because you're taking in so much more information, you notice less outside of expectations?
Well, I mean, to the extent that you're better able to focus, yes, that's right. So the more you're able to focus on selectively on the thing you're trying to do, the less likely you will be to notice unexpected things like a gorilla in a basketball game. But this is a question of whether, given that you're able to focus to comparable degrees, can people who can hold on to more stuff at once, are they more likely to notice because they just have more resources? And that doesn't seem to be the case. Unexpected things don't seem to grab attention automatically, regardless of how many resources you have.
So 50% of the people are still not going to see the gorilla at the basketball game.
It seems like it's 50% of the people, and it's the interesting question is it the same 50%? So are there 50% of us out there who are just clueless and never would see the gorilla, and 50% who would always see it? Or is it the case that if I could get you to miss it once, and then I showed it, were able to show you to you again, which doesn't work because, of course, now you know there's a gorilla, but imagine that you could forget about ever having seen a gorilla and I could do the task again. Would the people who missed it the first time be more likely to miss it the second time? It's a hard study to do, but the answer, at least so far, seems to be maybe it doesn't predict.
What happens, and has work been done where you show the video and the people don't see the gorilla, and you show it to them again, and maybe they see it, maybe they don't, but they don't know whether you're going to show them the version with the gorilla or without the gorilla?
It's a very interesting question. So if we show it to them the first time and we ask them about the gorilla, right, then from that point forward, they're always looking for gorillas. And that's the real problem, that if you want to do this task more than once, you have to find a way of not having them expect something unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
We have done variants. I've got a new variant of the gorilla video. If people want to look for it on YouTube, it's search for the monkey business illusion. And that one is basically looking at this sort of a question. But I won't spoil it for anybody. But
no,
it's basically
don't.
The same sort of task.
Daniel Simons, the book is The Invisible Gorilla and Other Ways Our Intuitions Deceive Us. Daniel, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.